The following program is a paid production of Mike Novak, LLC. The opinions, rants, confessions, and lame jokes presented are not necessarily the views of WCPT or its parent corporation, NewsWeb Radio. Besides, if Mike was running for office, the tapes of these shows alone would get him kicked off the ballot. Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on South Pulaski Road, just across the street from the 53A bus stop and in between Paco's Tacos and Zaka Tacos, it's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast green, gardening, and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes.
Hey there, folks. This is the Mike Novak Show on WCPT, Chicago's progressive radio station. And no, Mike's voice has not changed. This is Beth Botts. I'm sitting in for Mike Novak today because he is goofing off somewhere. We don't really know where, but somebody had to be on the radio, so here I am. And Heather Fry, our magnificent and highly skilled producer.
Oh, I thank you, Beth.
Is going to be running the show and doing all the electronic stuff and keeping us out of trouble. And hopefully all I have to do is talk. But we'll just kind of have to see how this goes today. We have an interesting show lined up today. It's kind of heavy on gardening today. We're going to have Diane Blazek from the All-America Selections group out in Downers Grove that trials new seed varieties. We're also going to have Claire Watson of Thompson & Morgan and the National Garden Bureau, who's going to be here to talk to us sort of about what some good seed shopping tips are and how to read those catalog descriptions and those seed packets when you're out seed shopping. And then in the second hour, we're going to get into rain gardens and the whole idea of the design of rain gardens and the reasons we have rain gardens and what we can do to get rain gardens more widely adopted in gardening. We're going to have Rick DeMaio's weather forecast, which is always interesting. And then we're going to have some chat, and we're hoping somebody will call in and ask us a gardening question, and we'll try to answer it. And that's it, and we'll see how it goes. So, Heather, say something.
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 No, yeah, I'm excited. This is fun. I'm glad Mike deserves a day off. I'm glad he's taking one.
He deserves a day off.
He does.
Yeah.
I still wonder if he's compelled to listen, though.
He probably is listening on the radio.
He's probably already
embarrassed.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure he's already like, oh, she already messed something up.
Okay. So a little background on me. I am a garden writer, and I have a blog at growinginchicago.com. And I also write sometimes for the Chicago Tribune. I have a story in today, actually, about the Midwest Gardening Symposium at the Morton Arboretum, which is coming up on March 5th to 7th. And the story goes into sort of some good plant suggestions and some bad plant suggestions from the speakers at the Morton Arboretum Symposium. So if you have a garden, you might want to look that up. It's also on the web at chicagotribune.com. I'm also a senior editor at Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. And
you're a master gardener as well.
I am a master gardener as well. So I have some training and theoretically some credentials in this whole garden.
I'd say so. You've got your roots firmly planted.
I have my roots firmly planted.
I think you're all right.
And if I don't know the answer to a gardening question, I can fake it. Or I can go look it up.
Those are my options.
I have a few things that I can mention that are going on in the Chicago sort of greening and gardening world this week. In fact, this afternoon, after you finish listening to the show, you might want to head up to the Glenwood at 6962 North Glenwood on the north side in the 49th Ward, where they are holding a chili cook-off. And you're asking yourself, why are we talking about chili cook-offs on a gardening and greening radio show? Well, the purpose of this chili cook-off is to support a new farmer's market that they have, that they're setting up in the Glenwood neighborhood. And, you know, we're very much in favor of farmers markets, of locally grown food, of people growing food in their either buying food at farmers markets or growing food themselves in the city. And, you know, not everybody can grow everything that they eat in the city. So the next best thing is to go to your local farmers market and buy it from local farmers. One of the reasons that we're going to be talking about seeds today is because there do seem to be a whole lot more people undertaking to grow some of their food.
Yeah, it's encouraging to see. I want to start flower boxes of my own at home.
Yeah.
You know, beans or whatever I can.
Yeah, and you know, you don't need a vegetable plot to do that. You don't need a quarter of an acre that you can plow up with a rototiller to do that. I don't have that. I have just a shade garden in Oak Park. Most of my garden's on the north side of a four-story building. You're not going to grow any vegetables in the shade on the north side of a four-story building. So I grow my tomatoes in pots on the third floor back porch.
I've seen those things too. Where you can hang them out the window now, and they grow upside down. And like,
yeah,
not
crazy.
Do those work?
I'm not crazy about the upside down tomato planter because it just it doesn't have enough space for the root system of a mature tomato plant.
See?
And when I tried those things, I was there's basically nothing in that. It's sort of a bag. There's nothing in that bag except roots. There's no soil to hold any water, and I was out there three times a day watering those plants. So I would strongly recommend getting
a nice big pot.
A nice big pot, something with enough space to hold a good volume of soil. And the rule of thumb that I give people for this is a 5-gallon bucket. You need something that's as big as a 5-gallon bucket to successfully grow a tomato plant. There are various kinds of self-watering containers. They're not actually self-watering. You do have to water them. But
see, I was speaking my language because I either overwater or starve the poor thing.
Well, those are good because they have a sort of a reservoir. You pour the water into a reservoir underneath the plant's roots, and the plant's roots sort of suck the water up. And one of the virtues about it is it has an overflow valve, so you cannot overwater the plants, which is a good thing for beginner gardeners, because I think a lot of new gardeners tend to either forget to water the plants completely or they water them too much.
Exactly. And that's how I've killed half my house plants easily.
Yeah.
Trying over-nurturing.
Over-nurturing.
Over-watering. Over-nurturing.
Yeah.
I want you
to
live and I've killed you.
Right.
But is it better to start from seeds than...
Well, you know, it kind of depends. Starting from seeds is cheap. It's much cheaper than buying the transplants, but you can get a much wider variety of plants in the seeds. On the other hand, if you're a new gardener, if you're just starting, it might be easier to let somebody else in some greenhouse somewhere start the seeds for you, essentially, and just buy the plants when they're ready to be transplanted outside. Which is generally another new gardener. Thing that new gardeners tend to do is to plant too early.
Mm.
Because around here we have this crazy erratic weather.
No.
Yes.
I was walking around without my coat on yesterday for a couple hours.
I know. Yeah. I run into people. I travel around the country and I'm talking to gardening people and they say, oh, how do you garden in Chicago? It's so cold. And I say, well, you know, it's not always cold. The thing about it is you never know what it's going to be.
Right.
And it drives the plants as crazy as it drives us. And so one thing that people tend to do is they tend to put those vegetable transplants out a little bit too early.
Mm-hmm.
And it's better to wait a little bit later.
Yeah.
especially for things like tomatoes and peppers, which are actually kind of semi-tropical plants.
Oh, really?
Yes, they are. They come from down in Central America where it's much, the days are much longer. And so, you know, latter half of May, I know people who don't set their tomatoes out until June.
Oh,
so,
wow. Now, this would be the time, though, to do start your seeds.
This would be the time to start your seeds. And we'll get into this with Diane and Claire. But
I have Diane on the line.
You have Diane on the line.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, let's get into it with Diane and Claire.
All right.
Diane, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Well, hello there.
Hello, Beth, and hello, Heather.
Good morning.
And let's talk about who you are, Diane. You are the new head of All America Selections and the National Garden Bureau.
Correct, yes. 2 months into it, I have taken over for Nona, who is enjoying her well-deserved retirement now.
Absolutely. She was the head of those organizations for about 25 years, right?
Exactly, yeah. If she had stayed just a couple more months, she would have hit the 26-year mark. So it's... She's had a phenomenal run with it, and AAS and NGB, if we're going to talk in acronyms, you know, is certainly, they're both very solid organizations. So this is just a total honor to be able to take over from Nona.
And let's talk a little bit about what All America Selections does.
Okay. AAS started back in 1932, and the idea was to start trialing new varieties that the breeders are introducing to the market. And what we would do is trial them before they were truly introduced to the consumer. And we have trial sites, almost 40 different trial gardens throughout the U.S. and Canada. And what happens is these judges, who are independent horticulture experts, are looking at these new varieties and judging their worthiness. You know, are they improvements over the other things that are already on the market? Are they growing better, producing better? Is it better tasting tomatoes, for example, than the other varieties that they're compared to?
And these are all seed grown varieties, right?
For right now, yes, we are all seed grown varieties.
Okay.
No, we're in a process where we're looking a little bit more broadly beyond that, but as of right now, yes, we're just trialing the seed varieties.
And all the winners going back, I'm not sure they go back to 1932, but all the winners going back a long way are on your website, right?
Exactly. Yes, they are. And you can sort by flower, vegetable, or year. Yeah, they're all on the website.
And that is AAS.com, right?
Well, actually, it's a little bit of a longer URL.
Okay.
So it's ALL-AmericaSelections.com.
Ah, okay. ALL-AmericaSelections.com.
Yeah.
Okay, and the National Garden Bureau is basically a trade association of seed growers, right?
It would be breeders and growers and distributors and seed packet companies and mail order companies, so it's pretty broad. And what we're trying to do is just educate and inform both garden writers and the public about gardening.
Yeah, there's a lot of good information, folks, about seed growing on the NGB website. And, Diane, why don't you give us the URL for that?
Now, that one's easier. That's just ngb.org.
Okay, great. And do we have Claire on the line?
Yes, we do.
Claire, are you there?
Yes, we do. Hold on. Let me bring her in.
Claire, this is...
Oh, darn it. I just lost Diane.
Oh, dear. We just lost Claire Watson. Okay. Well, we have a dial tone there. Once we get Claire Watson on the line, Claire Watson is with Thompson & Morgan Seeds, which is one of the big seed companies. Many of you have probably gotten a Thompson & Morgan seed catalog. I got about three myself. And Claire Watson is also on the board of the National Garden Bureau. Is that true, Diane?
No,
we've lost everybody. Okay. Well, the plan is for us to talk a little bit about being consumers of seeds. And I myself have some questions about this. There are some...
Diane's back.
Diane, you're back?
Yes, I'm back.
Sorry.
You're back. Okay, we're going to try for Claire
rookie
now.
Rookie mistake.
The idea here is to talk a little bit about being a good consumer of seeds and what you can look for in those catalog listings and what you can look for on the seed packet. Some of the terminology is kind of confusing, especially if you're a new gardener. And one of the things that I think people hang up on especially is you'll have days to maturity. And it'll just say something like 60 days or 75 days or 110 days. And my question always is, days from what? Is that from the day you sow the seed? Is that from the day you put the transplant in the ground? What does that number mean? Is Claire there?
Yes.
Claire?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Claire. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Bright and early this morning.
Yes, yes. So you're with Thompson & Morgan Seeds, right?
Yes, that's right.
That's great. And we're here to ask you, we're very happy to have you on the show today, and we're here to ask you some questions about sort of being a good consumer of seeds and figuring out some of the terminology on the seed packets and in the seed catalogs.
Okay, well, sure, I'll be happy to help.
And one of the specific questions that I was going to ask is about this sort of days to maturity number that you see in a lot of those descriptions you see on the seed packet. And often it'll just say 65 days or 75 days or 113 days. And what does that mean?
Okay, well, it can vary between different companies. We at Thompson & Morgan use days to harvest. That's what our days mean. So that means from when you sow the seed to when you're going to be able to either harvest your vegetables or see your flowers in bloom.
But even if it's something where you're going to start the seeds inside and you're going to transplant it, you're still counting it from the day you sow the seed, right?
You sow the seed. That's in our particular catalog and in our particular packets, that's what we mean. So sometimes you might see days to harvest, and as you say, you might see days to maturity. So you just need to be careful about whether you're reading days to harvest or days to maturity.
And the other thing is that I think it, with some seed companies, it can vary about whether it means days to harvest or days to maturity from when you plant or
when you sow, correct?
Or when you sow, and that can vary by the variety of vegetable, right?
Absolutely.
If it's something like tomatoes that you're going to start indoors, it might be days from transplant.
It may well be, and again, with all the different, the wonderful different varieties of tomato available these days, you get some early ones which you might be able to mature in sort of 90 days, but then others which might take as long as 120 days.
So you really kind of, when you're shopping in a catalog or you're shopping on a website, you really kind of need to pin them down on what their particular terminology in their
particular catalog means. And also take account of where you live. If you're in the north of the country, you'd be ideally looking for a shorter day to maturity because you don't have quite as many days of the warm weather and sunlight that you need for a plant like tomatoes.
Okay, so your long season varieties would be like if you're growing tomatoes down in Alabama or someplace.
Absolutely.
Okay. Another thing that I think people hang up on a lot is the idea of organic.
Well, that's a very interesting question, Beth. Technically, an organic seed, when it's certified organic, it means that it's been approved as being grown from a plant that has also been grown organically. And there's very rigorous testing around being able to use the term organic for your seeds. But I think you'll find that most of the seed companies today are using natural seeds. I mean, you could say most of them are not treated for the consumer. They are natural. And really, although you might, you know, if you're growing a strictly organic garden, then that's great, buy organic seeds. But really, most seeds are very natural and easy to grow products.
And Diane, your organizations represent growers of both organic and conventional seed, right?
Correct, yes.
And the thing about organic is, you can buy organic seed that comes from a plant that was organically grown,
yes.
But then you don't necessarily have to grow it by organic methods.
Right.
Because the organicness, is that a word?
We'll make it a word. It's a new word.
It can be one. The organicness is a quality of the way the seed was, the plant the seed came from was grown. It's not a quality of the plant itself, right?
Correct.
So, roughly, you know, what would you say if you, if you're going to plan to grow these organic seeds organically? What would you be doing that would be different from growing them conventionally? You'd be avoiding, you know, maybe chemical fertilizers. You'd be avoiding pesticides.
Well, what you would be looking for is growth medias that are deemed organic. You know, if you're using anything to control pests and diseases, you have to go to the garden center and also look for things that are organic. You have to make sure that before you started the garden that there was nothing put on that ground or it's been left fallow for a certain length of time. So there's a lot of different factors involved if you truly want to have an organic garden. There's tons of books out there that could be good resources.
And one of the things that I've noticed in recent years, and one of the things I've actually noticed in the All-America selections in recent years, is a tendency towards sort of more dwarf and more plants, especially vegetable varieties, that are suitable for growing in containers. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And Claire can add to this if she wants to. But I think that's one of the majorly exciting portions of vegetable gardening right now is, instead of the varieties that I remember as a kid that would get, you know, as tall as your house, yeah, they're being bred so that you can grow them on your patio or your deck. And so that's why everybody can get into vegetable gardening. And not only are the U.S. breeders doing this, but, you know, it's becoming a smaller world, and we're attracting breeders from other countries that are entering their varieties. And the same thing goes, you know, especially in Asia and Europe. It's, let's grow in these containers so that more people can. You don't have to have a one-acre lot or what it might be.
Yeah, I imagine actually in a lot of countries they have these huge mega cities, and if you're going to be growing tomatoes at all, you're probably growing, you know, in even more compact spaces than we have in American cities.
Mm-hmm.
And let me ask you something about ordering seeds from overseas. And Claire, I've always wondered about this because Thompson & Morgan has an American catalog and it has a British catalog.
Yes, that's right. And it's not always easy ordering seeds from overseas. One of the reasons is that all the seeds have to be tested and they have to be certified free of pest and disease. We don't want to be bringing in anything, any noxious weeds or any prohibited items into the United States. We want to keep what we've got here, you know, in good condition, not introducing any diseases. So, you know, my advice would be was really to try and buy from within your own country. There's some great seed suppliers, some great catalogs, some great seeds available in your garden centers and in the stores. And I think you can find more than enough from your homegrown companies.
And, you know, a good source for finding catalogs is the Mail Order Gardening Association.
Absolutely. There's a tremendous selection there of all different companies specializing in all different things. If you grow organic, if you prefer an heirloom garden, if you're into flower gardening, if you're into the more rare and unusual things that we supply, there's all sorts of options for every gardener.
And Diane, is there a list of the National Garden Bureau members on that website?
Oh yes, there is. When you click on it, you'll see where you can go to find members,
mm-hmm.
and from there, then it tells you which ones are offering mail order versions. Because we have some that are selling commercially and professionally only, and there's others that are mail order for consumers. So yeah, you can find that on the NGB site.
And the NGB site is just ngb.org?
Yes. And if I can clarify something, when we were talking about All America Selections, I think we said .com, but it's .org as well.
Okay, so that's allamericaselections.org?
Yeah, with a hyphen between all and America.
Okay, so all-americaselections.org.
Correct.
And I want to thank you both. We're going to have to wrap up and get prepared to hear Rick DeMaio's weather. But I really want to thank Diane Blazek and Claire Watson for being on the show this morning and helping us out with our seed shopping. I think there are also a lot of excellent tips both for seed ordering and for seed and for growing vegetables on the ngb.org site.
Yes.
And I really recommend looking on that. And if you check the All America Selections website, it's kind of fun because you can actually see some of those varieties going back to the 1930s. And I actually ordered Blue Boy Bachelor Buttons this year. I wanted to try those because I think those were an All America Selection in like 1939 or something.
Yeah, yeah. You're getting one of the older ones, which is wonderful.
They're wonderful, yeah. So it's a lot of fun. But you can also sort of see how fashions have changed in gardening over the years. So that's great. And you'll also see this year's All-America Selections. I know there's a chili pepper, right?
Yes, yeah. Cajun Bell is our newest introduction.
Cajun Bell's chili pepper. So check that out if you're into chili peppers. And thank you both very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you, Beth, and have a great Sunday.
Thank you. Great to have you on the radio.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye. So it's still a little early to get planting outside, but there are ways to start playing in the dirt. In fact, there's no time like the present to pick out your flower and vegetable seeds and start them indoors. Why start from seed? You'll save money, you have fun, and you can grow exactly the varieties you like. Now is the time to start this year's vegetable garden, and SID's Greenhouses and Garden Center is ready to help. Their shipment of flower and vegetable seed packets is in, and we just learned some of the things to look for on those seed packets. So shelve those seed catalogs, because SID's has what you need. Looking for other ways to get your green fix? Then plan to attend SID's 21st Annual Garden Expo, coming up on March 5th and 6th in Palos Hills. You'll be able to meet the reps, attend seminars like Mike Novak's world-famous talk, I'm Not Really a Garden Expert, I Just Play One on the Radio, at 11:30 on Friday, March 5th. And you'll see the newest products and programs for spring. Best of all, admission and parking are free. SID's, Chicagoland's premier garden centers, are located in Palos Hills, on Southwest Highway, and in Bolingbrook on Napier Plainfield Road at Hassert Boulevard. Are you familiar with Aldo Leopold? He's considered the father of wildlife ecology. I remember reading that book when I was maybe 11 or 12 years old. My mother forced it on me. My mother is a big environmental activist. Aldo Leopold was a renowned scientist and scholar, teacher, philosopher, and writer out of Wisconsin. It is for his book, A Sand County Almanac, that Leopold is best known around the globe. The Almanac, a literary landmark in conservation, combines poetic prose with observations of the natural world. The Almanac led to a philosophy that has guided many to discovering what it means to live in harmony with the land and with each other. WRD Environmental would like you to remember something that Aldo Leopold wrote. He said, "The outstanding scientific discovery of the 20th century is not television or radio, but rather the complexity of the land organism. Only those who know the most about it can appreciate how little we know about it. The last word in ignorance is the man who says of an animal or plant, 'What good is it?' If the land mechanism is as a whole is good, then every part is good, whether we understand it or not. If the biota in the course of eons has built something we like but do not understand, then who but a fool would discard seemingly useless parts? To keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering." At WRD Environmental, they not only appreciate the complexity of our region's ecology, but are dedicated to protecting, restoring, and healing it. WRD creates sustainable landscapes from large-scale master planning to community pocket parks. For innovative, sustainable landscape development, choose WRD Environmental, located at the Chicago Center for Green Technology and online at wrdenvironmental.com. Mm-hmm.
Went to a garden party, reminisce is with my old friend. A chance to share old memories, play songs again.
Okay, so this is the Mike Novak Show. I am not Mike Novak. I have never been Mike Novak. I never intend to be Mike Novak. I am Beth Botts. I am subbing for Mike Novak today because he is off, I think, probably gallivanting around in the Michigan woods. That was the last plan that I heard. And so I'm sort of winging it here with Heather Fry, our producer.
You're doing great, Beth. I'm having so much fun.
All right. And we're just about to get to Rick DeMaio, our ace weather forecaster. And Rick, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Beth. Good morning.
Good morning.
You have something against Mike? You don't want to be him? You don't want to ever be him? You don't want anything to do with him? What's with that?
There's a lot, I think, that goes with being Mike Novak. It's right up there with being John Malkovich.
Yes.
Having to lower your head when walking through hallways that are lower than 6'5", right?
Exactly.
Tall, lanky fella, right?
So Mike.
Rick.
Rick.
See, we got Mike on the brain.
Mike, we got Nick. We got Mike on the mind. We got Rick on the radio.
He's channeling his energy.
Yeah. My understanding is that we got a lot of snow on the way. Is that right?
Yeah. Beth, runner of Winter Storm Watch. Right now, it looks like the bulk of any precipitation is probably not going to get here until probably late this afternoon. We emphasize late because obviously a lot of people like to get out and about and do a bunch of things. Particularly because sometimes you have a nice Saturday like we had yesterday, and you get out on Sunday, you go, oh, I need to do a bunch of things today, I need to get out and about and take care of some chores. And the one thing people want to know about is when they hear snow on a Sunday, they think that it's going to obviously either ruin their travel plans or, inhibit their ability to drive. But don't worry about it. This is not the kind of snow that's going to impact us, particularly for the late afternoon and evening. It's going to be more of a overnight into Monday morning type of event.
So this would be a good day to get out there and do your seed chopping, right? So that tomorrow when it's snowy, you can be indoors, setting up your lights and all that stuff.
Yeah, I guess that's something you can do today. I was hoping to get out and do some cross-country skiing. Last week I spoke to Mike from Devil's Head Lake State Park up in Baraboo. Have you ever been up in that area?
I have. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful, and the snow is fantastic. It was a perfect kind of dry, crusty snow. Temperatures had fallen back into the single digits overnight, so whatever snow was on the ground was nice and dry when I went out for my morning run. But now we've had the last 3 days, we've had temperatures above freezing. We had a high of 39 on Thursday. We had a high of 41 on Friday. We went up to 39 yesterday. And what meteorologists look for, Beth, prior to the beginning of a snow event, is how much sunlight got into the pavement, got into the sidewalk, in other words, radiation. And because the ground, because the streets have been rather wet and warm lately, I do think the first couple of hours of any snow falling late this afternoon or early this evening is probably just going to melt on contact. That's why we want to stress that when the snow does arrive later on today, it's probably not going to do any, probably not going to cause any icing problems. So we're looking for wet snow beginning sometime late this afternoon. However, between about midnight, between about 9 o'clock and midnight, we can easily see 2 or 3 inches. And by this time tomorrow morning, I would not be surprised if much of the Chicagoland area has anywhere between about 4 and about 6 inches of snow. Now, the problem with this event, Beth, is that temperatures just to the south of, say, Interstate 80, in other words, parts of Will County, Kankakee County, Livingston, LaSalle, Iroquois, readings in that area are going to be right around 32, 33, 34 degrees. There's a good chance that a lot of the snow is going to be mixed in with a little bit of sleet and also rain. So a very slushy, probably 3 to 5 inches of accumulation south of us. And the best chance for, I think, the heaviest snowfall is going to be right across western suburban areas, Aurora, Naperville, parts of DuPage County, north central Cook County, and oddly enough, as you go further north with this storm, where the temperatures begin to cool off, we're not going to have as much snowfall. So places like Rockford, Rochelle, up around, say, northern sections of McHenry, Lake County, and even in the southern Wisconsin, accumulations may only get to about 4 or 5 inches, if that. And that's only because the storm system is really not traveling in the optimal position for heavy snow for Chicago. I'm looking at the satellite radar right now, shows a lot of thunderstorms developing across areas of Oklahoma and northern Texas. And that may actually rob this storm of a little bit of moisture, but the track is actually just south of St. Louis and even south of Indianapolis. And for Chicagoans, we know that when a storm goes directly over St. Louis or Indianapolis, that's usually the better chance for heavy snow for us. So a couple of things going against this storm for being a real heavy snowmaker, similar to like what we had the last event where we had about 6 or 12 inches.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah, that was a lot of snow. This is going to be a little bit further south. It's going to be a little bit warm, so your liquid to snow ratio, instead of being like maybe a 13-to-1, meaning if you get about, say, an inch of water, you get about 13 inches of snow. Right now, a lot of the numerical models are saying we'll get about maybe a half inch to 0.6 of an inch of water, and
okay,
that may yield about 5 or 6 inches of snow. So this is going to be great for gardeners because it's going to really percolate into the soil. As you know, this time of the year, that's pretty good stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we've keep dodging bullets. They keep getting these immense snowstorms out east, but it all seems to go north of us and south of us. We get these, what are comparatively speaking relatively benign snowstorms that leave us some nice snow cover on our gardens, some nice mm-hmm. insulating snow cover on our gardens, but they don't really cripple us the way you've been getting out east.
Well, I think one of the reasons why we haven't been crippled is I really think the city of Chicago and the Department of Transportation, the IDOT, and the local municipalities have really done a tremendous job with clearing the snow. I think there were a lot of problems last year when we went into the fiscal year. A lot of people were worried about the budget.
Yeah.
They were going to cut back on snow removal, and that lasted about 2 storms, and then obviously everybody was very upset about that. But I just remember how angry people were, particularly in the north side of Chicago where I live, when they said, "Wait a minute, what do you mean you're not going to plow the streets?"
Yeah,
within a matter of a week, that was over with.
Yeah, you live in Chicago, you really got to make snow your priority. And then on the other hand, out in Vancouver, it seems like they can't buy snow.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because the weather pattern, I'm looking at the satellite right now, and I sent you a couple of interesting links to look at weather. And if anybody is listening right now who's interested in Olympic weather, all you have to do is just do a Google of Environment Canada, and they have a great website. When you get on it, there's a little link to the right, and just Google Environment Canada. There's a little link that says Vancouver Olympic weather, and you click on that. And what they did was they set up this system of weather cameras where you can basically go from downtown Vancouver on the main highway right up into the Olympic ski village, and it's absolutely beautiful. If you do it now, you'll find out that you're like, wait a minute, why isn't the camera showing anything? Because it's obviously the sun hasn't really risen high enough. It's still a little dark out there. But I'm looking at the satellite, Beth, and the satellite imagery shows nothing but clear skies. So ever since they had that bout of rain and snow last week, basically since Monday afternoon, they have not had any clouds or snow, and they'll probably go into, from what I can see, today, tomorrow, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday as having basically a lot of sunshine. Now, you may say, okay, well, that's not good because they need the snow. I think right now they'll take it because the ski runs obviously had a lot of problems with too much snow and too much rain.
Right.
The lower levels are a little bit on the dry side, but, you know, that's the risk you take when you have the Olympics in an area that's within about 200 miles of the Pacific Ocean. The weather is obviously going to be somewhat of a concern.
Is there, like, some sort of El Nino effect happening with the Olympics?
Well, what is happening is El Nino is still quite strong. And when you get El Nino, a couple of things occur. You can either get strong systems pushing to the West Coast, meaning from about California northward up into Oregon and most likely southern Washington. Sometimes El Nino doesn't have an effect that much on British Columbia. But what El Nino has done this year is it's taken the storm track primarily from around San Francisco southward. And when I mean southward, I mean almost through Baja California, southern areas of Arizona, New Mexico. So just about every storm that has been a major storm in the United States this year has basically been born in parts of northern Mexico and western Texas. I think I've counted six different storms that came through northern Texas that was basically rain, but yet Oklahoma City was getting pounded with snow. In fact, since Christmas Day, Oklahoma City has had about 30 inches of snow. Since Christmas Day, Denver, Colorado has had 6.5. And those are amazing stats. In parts of eastern Colorado, through western Nebraska, southeast Wyoming, and particularly western areas of the Dakotas are basically in a drought right now. And if they don't get any appreciable rain or snow over the next month and a half, their winter wheat situation is in pretty bad shape because of the lack of rainfall. And that obviously, as you know, has a huge impact on going into the growing season. So to answer your question, El Nino has had an effect where it's kept the snow south of Vancouver, which is okay because you want all the snow in the world before the Olympics, but while it's going on, you basically want it to be nice and sunny and dry.
Well, that's true.
Right now.
That's true. Well, you know, I was out in Vancouver a couple years ago for a Garden Writers Association tour, and it is one of the things about the gardening territory out there is that it's very moderate because it's so close to the Pacific. And it's like the whole Pacific Northwest, Seattle, Portland, all those places, they have actually very moderate winters and very moderate weather, which is great for the nursery industry and great for greenhouses, but maybe not so great when you want a little bit severe weather right before you have your Olympics.
Right, right. Severe meaning obviously the way of snow. Yeah, you know, I've been out to Seattle a couple of times, and I noticed that they have a large variety of roses. Isn't that right?
Yeah, they have great, great roses out there.
Right, great roses. But again, even though they have a long growing season, I guess you have to worry about it sometimes where, you know, you may not get enough sunlight for certain types of varieties of flowers and plants. But one thing I know about that area is that it seems to have a climate that is kind of feast or famine. When it's wet, it gets very wet for a long period of time. And then when it gets sunny, you can have some absolutely gorgeous weather where they like to say in Seattle that the mountain is out, obviously
right,
referring to Mount Rainier. And then when you get into Vancouver, the mountains are pretty much about 15 miles away. In Seattle, they're a little bit further away, but the Vancouver area is absolutely wonderful from a standpoint of a large metropolitan area, the Pacific Ocean, the Straits of Juan de Fuca, are down to the south. That's a large sound that basically connects the Puget Sound up to Vancouver. And you have all this wonderful greenery, pretty much a stone's throw away. You are somewhat landlocked in that area. There's not much you can do up to the north. But it's absolutely fantastic. I would love to go out there again. And I told this to people before, some of the best time to visit some of these cities that have the Olympics is not before or during, but it's actually after. And that's usually when there's a lot of the fanfare left there. There's a lot of the leftover, feeling of the Olympics. And it's just, I've been to a couple Olympic cities after the Olympics have been held. And it's really a great joy to do, particularly during the summertime.
Yeah, so, and you can get that done in Chicago before the gardening season starts. So
yeah, absolutely.
And it's actually a good thing for gardeners to do in Chicago because, toward the end of winter, Chicago gardeners get itchy.
Right. Well, you know, it was interesting because the other day when I was teaching a class at Oakland Community College, I said to everybody, okay, we're going to talk about the hydrologic cycle today. The first thing I did is I brought them outside, and I said, look, it's happening right there, okay? You have sunlight, you have snow, you have melting of the snow, you have evaporation, you have condensation going on. Later on tonight, you're going to have deposition, which is the frost that develops after the moisture from the leftover snow melt. And if we didn't have this snow, we'd probably get up to 45 degrees. And it was basically a lab assignment. And I said, this is really, really good stuff to have all the snow slowly melt into the soil. This will percolate down because we get into the whole percolation and infiltration and transpiration. And it really gives students a good understanding, a good appreciation for what it takes to get into your growing season. So often people say, oh, I hate winter, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? It's a natural cycle. It makes things grow. And who knows, in another 2 or 3 weeks, we may begin to see crocuses showing up because the pattern, once we get past the snow, even though it remains cold for a while, I think it looks pretty good about a month out. It looks like it gets nice and warm as we head into early February, which begins in 9 days, or March.
March. And so the if you look close, the buds are starting to swell on the trees. It's going to get to be gardening pretty soon. So thanks so much, Rick, for the weather forecast. And this is Rick DeMaio. His website is DeMaioWeather.com. And you can find all sorts of fascinating minutiae about Chicago weather on Rick's website. So thanks a lot, Rick. I really appreciate your coming on the radio today.
You're welcome. And just to finish up, Beth, just let everybody know, about 4 or 5 inches north, about 6 inches here in the city, and about 3 to 4 inches of slushy snow across the southern suburbs. And it'll all be gone by tomorrow afternoon, just to make sure that people understand the forecast.
Okay. Okay,
so take care.
Lots of snow, but no sweat. Okay.
No sweat. There you go.
Okay, great. Thanks much, Rick.
Bye-bye.
And
we're going to take a quick break, and
we'll
be right back with Beth
here, and be right back.
Attention teachers! Want your class to really engage in American history? OneHistory.org has presentations that make history come alive. A 10-year-old Civil War powder monkey. A Depression-era 7-year-old pushing a horse plow. A group of teenage girls facing off against Southern bigots in the Civil Rights Movement. We know how to reach your students. Whether it's for a history class or providing a context for American literature, our presentations get to the heart of history. OneHistory.org. The truth is in the details. Check out our website, www.onehistory.org. That's www.onehistory.org. Or call us at 216-956-6300. 216-956-6300.
Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. Choosing a tree for your property is part art and part science. City trees have to tolerate some tough conditions, including wintertime road salt spray. We're going to have this a lot of salt applied in the next 24 hours. Wintertime road salt spray and runoff. Roots have a hard time penetrating Chicago area soil, which is typically clayey, with rocks and rubble mixed in, some of it dating back to the Great Chicago Fire. Chicago soil also tends to be alkaline, which means it has a high pH, making it hard for some trees to extract the essential nutrients they need. Some of those trees are pin oak and red maple trees. Meanwhile, asphalt streets and parking lots soak up heat, creating urban heat islands that put additional stress on trees in summer. And, of course, Chicago trees must be able to withstand extreme cold, too. The Care of Trees can help you make the right decisions about choosing a tree with 9 locations. The Care of Trees has been serving Chicagoland for 60 years, putting you and your trees first. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard or you're changing your landscaping, invite the certified arborist at the Care of Trees to take a look. See thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. That's 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees. Their business is people and their love for trees.
DR Services Unlimited has been providing Chicago's North Shore with award-winning remodeling and design-build services since 1991, giving their clients top-quality service and real value. They're on the cutting edge of green building technology, helping clients make their home more energy efficient without sacrificing beauty or function. If you want to make your home more energy efficient, simply want to add a room or renovate, call DR Services at 847-998-1687 or visit them at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
This is the Mike Novak Show on 820 AM in Chicago and a whole bunch of other frequencies if you don't get 820 AM. You can find this show on 92.5 FM, 92.7 FM, 99.9 FM, and of course, 820 AM. This is the Mike Novak Show, the gardening and greening show for Chicago. And I am not Mike Novak. I am Beth Botts. I am substituting for Mike today while he's taking a day
You're
off.
You're a guest host. You're not a sub.
I'm guest host.
Substitute makes you sound like, you know, a school teacher that no one wants to see. But you're a master gardener extraordinaire on your own.
I am a master gardener. I'm a garden writer. I blog at growinginchicago.com. And if you hear things mentioned on this radio show, you can find links for most of these things in a post at my blog, which is growinginchicago, all one word, .com. And I just want to say about the carob trees. We actually had them come out and trim some trees in our yard not too long ago, and it's pretty amazing to watch these guys. They basically shinny up your trees. They have a lot of safety ropes and stuff, but my apartment's on the third floor, so I was able to watch them work.
Oh, that's cool.
From my living room window, and these guys who are sort of, you know, hanging up there in your trees, stepping from branch to branch, slinging a chainsaw around, and it's pretty amazing to watch them work, but they did a great job on our trees, so I was very comfortable with it. And, well, I wasn't very comfortable with it. I was more comfortable with it when they got back down on the ground.
Yeah. I've seen, like, those lumberjack shows, too, where they've got the little spikes in their boots and they just shimmy up really
right.
fast. I'd be scared to death. I'd be clinging to that thing with white-knuckled.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're very cool about it. They do a lot of preparation. You watch them, you know, it's like packing a parachute. They're very, very careful how they roll their rope up, you know, so that there aren't any snags. And they climb up the tree and then they use the rope to pull the chainsaw up, and it's quite a thing, and I had never really seen it close up, so it was an adventure.
And the trees are happier now; they've pruned
the
and healthy.
The trees will be happier.
Yeah.
They prune trees in the middle of winter because the trees are dormant, and it's not. First of all, it's easier to see because there aren't a lot of leaves on the trees, but secondly, because you know, trees and shrubs are dormant this time of year, and you can prune them without sort of forcing a big burst of growth. And this is reminding me that I have a bunch of shrubs that I need to get out there and prune that I haven't actually done.
Well, this is the time of year, right?
Start this is
your
the
seeds,
time of year
prune
to do
your
it.
Shrubs.
I always say, you know, roughly between Groundhog Day and St. Patrick's Day is the best time to be pruning trees and shrubs in Chicago. And so, I need to do that.
Yeah.
But that's
well, so
another
good.
Thing to do. That's another thing to do if you're a gardener and you're itchy and it's the end of winter and you really want spring to be here, but it really isn't here yet, is to sharpen up your pruners and get out there and do some dormant pruning. And, you know, I always recommend sort of natural form pruning rather than that kind of sharp geometric shearing. But in the winter time, you can really see the structure of your trees and your shrubs. And
what do you mean by sharp geometric shearing and as opposed to natural? I'm just what's the difference?
Well, you know, the people who take the electric hedge trimmer and they just sort of
and just
carve
make a cute little shape.
The shrubs
gotcha.
into squares or, you know, for some people it's a hobby.
Yeah.
Some people
I've
really
seen
enjoy
that. Like, oh yeah.
You know, they have these whole front yards full of shapes not found in nature that are executed in yews or and of course it's very traditional to have, you know, pruned boxwoods in very formal gardens. And, you know, and there's a place for that. And some people just like that.
Yeah.
But it's actually a whole lot less work to to prune your trees. So you prune your shrubs. I keep saying prune your trees. I strongly recommend for pruning trees, get a professional.
An arborist.
I do not recommend that anybody who's not professionally trained climb a ladder with a chainsaw.
No,
I mean, just don't
that just
do
smells
it, folks.
Disaster. Because, you know, gravity's going to come into play and something
gravity's
ugly's gonna
come
going
into
to
play.
Happen.
This chainsaws are chainsaws. We don't want to deal with chainsaws. But certainly shrubs and you know, just prune out the dead wood and you just sort of look at that shrub and you say, okay, if this were an ideal shrub of this kind, what would it be shaped like? And just, you know, I love pruning. For me, there's a sort of a zen to it. You know, you make a cut and then you step back and you look at it and then you step back and you make another cut and
It designs itself in its own right.
It kind of designs itself in its, you know, every shrub has a way it wants to grow. And, you know, you're also looking out for things like getting it out of the way of the sidewalk and, you know, all those sort of practical functional things. But, it's mostly about sort of keeping the shrub healthy. You want to open up the shrub so you get good air circulation through the shrub, because when you get really dense shrubs, especially some things like lilacs that are sort of prone to fungus diseases anyway.
Those are my favorite flowers. Lilacs are my absolute favorite.
Yeah,
I love lilac
wonderful.
Season. Oh,
they
but
are
yeah,
wonderful.
But I've seen people over prune and then nothing happens next year, and then
right.
you know that they think that it's going to come back bigger and fuller. And I've seen this work and.
Sometimes it
misfire.
Works and sometimes it doesn't. You really do have to know your shrubs. It's really worthwhile to figure out what the shrubs in your yard are and what kind of pruning they need. And if you need help with that, a really good source is the Morton Arboretum. They have a great plant clinic out there. You can find the number, which I don't have offhand, but you can find it at mortonarb.org. And those people know everything about woody plants. In the Chicago region and are very good at giving you answers about exactly what you need to do.
Well, that's perfect. The Arboretum, I can't wait for summer. I want to go there. But we're going to break momentarily. We're going to bring in CNN News and come into the next hour of the Mike Novak Show. I don't know why that didn't work.
Okay, well, we have a technical glitch here,
yeah.
folks. This is the Mike Novak Show on WCPT, 820 AM. This is Mike Novak's gardening and greening and environmental show, but Mike Novak is not here today. This is Beth Botts, who is not Mike Novak, but is a friend of Mike Novak. I'm a garden writer. I write some for the Chicago Tribune. I have a story in the Sunday section of the Chicago Tribune today. I also write for Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. I have a blog at growinginchicago.com where you will find a lot of links related to today's show. And I'd like to encourage anybody who has a garden question to give us a call, and we will do our best to get it answered. The number for that is 773-838-WCPT. That is 773-838-9278. And how are we doing on the technological difficulties there, Heather?
Let me see. It's not firing. Why?
It's not
I don't
firing.
Know. It's queued correctly. I know I got these set up right. So I just, it's our gremlin. It's our house gremlin.
We're having a radio gremlin here.
Well, this is just... Mike Novak Show has been brought to you by The Care of Trees, their business is people and their love for trees, and WRD Environmental, and also Sid's Greenhouses, one of the best, greenhouses in the Chicagoland area is Sid's. I've been in there, and it's absolutely breathtaking.
It's absolutely great. They have locations in Palos. I always have to check. Is it Palos Hills or Palos Heights? It's Palos Hills and in Bolingbrook, and they're both great locations. And we have a new topic for this hour of the show. I want to introduce the whole idea of rain gardens. We hear about a lot about rain gardens and, you know, people think, oh, wow, cool. That sounds like a great thing to do. And there are, good sort of environmental reasons to have that kind of a garden, included in your landscape. And we're going to be talking to Jim Kleinwachter, who's the head of Conservation at Home for the Conservation Foundation out in Naperville. We're also going to be talking to Andrea Green, who is a garden designer from Oak Park. Is Jim on the phone?
Yeah.
And is Jim on the phone here?
Not yet.
No, Jim's not on the phone yet, but Jim will shortly be on the phone. We're going to talk to them sort of about the reasons for having rain gardens. And can we get Jim on the phone?
Yeah, we'll get Jim on the phone right now. I just want to let you know, Andrea's here in studio, and her
Andrea
mic is ready to go.
Is here in the studio. So,
good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Beth. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Did I say Beth?
Yes, you did.
Good morning, Andrea. How are you? We know how Beth is. Beth is kind of confused about this whole radio thing.
I don't know what happened there, so but we're fine.
Yes, we're okay. So, why would you have a rain garden? I'll talk a little bit about rain gardens. One of the big concerns, one of the big environmental concerns that's coming up in the world is water and the whole management of water. And if you see a lot of the concerns that are coming up in landscape design, there's something called the Sustainable Sites Initiative that is being developed. That's sort of the idea is to have a kind of an LEED for landscapes. And one of the big concerns about among people who are thinking about the future of landscape design is water, because as the climate changes, we're expecting that water will become more of an issue, even in places like Chicago, where we seem to have a multitude, an ample quantity of water. You still have water issues, and one of the reasons you do is because we have a combined sewer system where our sewers are connected. Our sanitary sewers and our storm sewers are basically the same system. And any water, any rainwater that goes down the storm sewer ends up in the sanitary sewer and has to be treated as polluted water before it can go back into rivers or waterways. And so we're essentially taking rainwater, which is relatively clean when it runs off your roof or runs off your driveway, and we're turning it into polluted water, and then we have to pay to treat it. And so one of the things we're thinking about when we're designing landscapes in today's world is we're trying to think about how we can keep that water on our property rather than sending it down the storm sewer. And how we can manage water so that the waterfall that falls on our roofs and our driveways stays on our property. Do we have Jim on the phone?
Yes, we do.
Jim, you there? Jim? Jim?
Try now.
Jim, you there?
I'm here, Beth.
All right.
Good morning.
Good morning. So talk to me a little bit about rain gardens and why you would want one.
Well, it's so important to kind of understand that we're using our high-quality drinking water and we're pouring it on our lawns and gardens when we use the hose. And that's something we just can't keep doing. We have some of the finest drinking water in the world here, Lake Michigan water and the aquifers around Chicago. And it's something we have to get away from, pouring that drinking water on our lawns. So you've got that concept, and then you've got the concept of what you were talking about earlier, the rain coming off your house and it washing into the drain systems and off into the rivers, which in our area, almost all the water that ends up in the river systems goes to the Mississippi Basin and pours out into the Gulf of Mexico.
And that actually, that's not the cleanest water in the world. That's causing some real pollution problems in the Gulf of Mexico, isn't it?
Well, it's carrying a lot of debris. So, you know, we do chemical applications on our yards, salt, and runoff from the streets. So you get antifreeze and oils and different things. It picks up all that pollution and washes down into the creeks and rivers. That's where you get the real problem, the cumulative effect of it passing through all these states, picking up debris.
And how does a rain garden address that?
Well, the native plants that have lived in this region for about 8,000 years have evolved with these huge root systems, and they absorb water. And if you can visualize in your mind a sponge, so during the dry months, the sponge is sitting there ready to absorb water. And these plants have evolved with these techniques of That's how they live through July and August. They store the rain from April and May, and they use it in July and August. It's easy to see on, like, a camel how animals can store water, but we don't visualize that in the plant world. So we're kind of like using the techniques that these plants have evolved with to our benefit. You plant the plants that absorb the water in these depressions where water is building in your yard, and let the plants absorb it and return it to the aquifer.
So it's just like a shallow depression in your yard, and it's really just sort of a place where rainwater can collect and soak in, right?
Right. Some cases, the yard has a wet spot, and people call me and say, I've got this wet spot that I don't know what to do with. And that's already a place where water is collecting, so that's a perfect spot for a rain garden. In some yards, the yards are pitched in such a way that the water runs off and never stops until it gets over the curb and off into the storm drain. In that case, you create a little depressed area, and you slow the water down with some rocks, perhaps, and then you plant these plants in this depression and allow that water just to slowly percolate into that area, and then the plants will do their thing.
Okay, but here's the problem. I was at MidAm in January, which is this big horticultural trade show at McCormick Place, and I was in an all-day seminar of landscape contractors. I was really encouraged to see a room full of landscape contractors listening to speakers about sustainability and sustainable gardens and really thinking about how they can put some of these sustainable values into their businesses. And that's really a step toward making these mainstream practices. But when we got to the point where we were looking at some slides of rain gardens, and you have these rain gardens full of native plants, and you have these rain gardens in front of people's houses who are obviously really committed and really devoted to sustainability values, and these landscape contractors who have a much more mainstream audience, they looked at that slide and there was just this groan that went through the room, and they said, I can't sell that to my customers. There's no way my customers would go for that. That it looks like a patch of weeds to a lot of people. And so we have here Andrea Green, who's a garden designer in Oak Park, and she's going to be speaking on how to have a prettier rain garden at the Midwest Gardening Symposium at the Morton Arboretum from March 5th to 7th. Andrea, thanks for being here. And let's talk a little bit about the design of rain gardens.
Well, that's an interesting question, because I, as a landscape designer, find the same resistance to planting rain gardens among residential customers. They have seen prairies, wet prairies, which would be rain gardens in homes, and they said, this looks very weedy. This looks like I haven't mown my lawn in weeks. I can't do this. So there's a big resistance to overcome in appearance and interpretation, and yet people want to have sustainable gardens. They want to deal with their water problems. So how to find a compromise where we get at least some of the benefits of the rain garden without forcing something on people that they find unattractive. One of the things to do, I think, is to loosen our definition of a rain garden a little bit. Native plants do have those adaptations that Jim talked about, absorbing water, being hardy to our areas. But we can also find plants from elsewhere, exotics from Europe, that tolerate those conditions, that like wet feet, that grow well in our areas, that we actually already invite into our gardens and find attractive. So I am all for not being a purist where it comes to a residential situation and saying, let's mix the natives, let's mix the ornamental plants, and try to find a group of plants that together look more garden-esque. Gardenesque is my word for something that doesn't look like nature. It looks like something you've actually planned to put in your garden. I think then that as soon as you start getting away from the model of what naturally occurs in nature, beautiful though it is, you can start thinking about other ways you create your garden and make it garden-esque. Can you bring in design elements such as a focal point, which could sit just as well in a rain garden
garden? Explain what you mean by a focal point.
Most gardens are like nature, are blousy and loose and irregular unless we do that coarse, tight pruning or impose straight lines. And our eye needs somewhere to come to rest. And a focal point can be a beautiful plant. It can be a beautiful sculpture. It can be an interesting piece of driftwood. It's anything that draws your eye as a starting point and a stopping point before your eye moves around the rest of the garden. And it's an organizing principle that says, here's the important spot, and now look at all the beautiful things around this important spot.
Jim, you run the Conservation at Home program at the Conservation Foundation in Naperville. And part of what you do in that program is to encourage people to plant rain gardens, right?
Right.
And do you find any kind of resistance among the people that you talk to?
Not really, because I use a lot of pictures. So I bring my laptop, and when I do presentations, I show them pictures of selected plants. Beth is right, is that you can't take the full spectrum of plants and just say any of these could be used. Some are far more decorative than others. And in a more manicured situation, you want an attractive look. But there's plenty of plants that fill that bill, and I work with them about clumping. So one of the ways you get that effect that Beth was talking about is
Andrea, I think.
Or yeah, excuse me. That instead of having a random collection of plants that looks unorganized, by clumping and having only maybe three or four species, then it looks like it's organized. Maybe spacing between them with a rock or, as Andrea had mentioned, a log or a piece of driftwood, you can make it look like a structured garden. But some of the native plants that we use, blazing star, the liatris, swamp milkweed, cardinal flower, lobelia, quite showy plants. And when people see what they can grow in those wet spots, they're very happy to go along that route.
And are there any limitations on the shape or size or, I mean, obviously the place the rain garden has to be is the low spot. But beyond that, are there any limitations on the shape or size, or could you have if you had a formal garden, could you have a rectangular rain garden?
Sure. We build them off of downspouts many times. The gutter system is a collection for your home, garage, and so on. They each have a downspout on the corner. And adjacent to that, your downspout would pour out. And those are places where the water is coming initially. So you can do small ones by each downspout. Or if there's a larger area out in the garden or somewhere where the water is already naturally collecting, you could focus on that spot. And it could be any shape that you prefer to have it.
So any shape that sort of goes with the style of your house and the style of the rest of your garden.
Sure. And there might be some, you know, you could get into some calculations about how much water is coming off your roof, and you can go online and calculate sizes of rain gardens and so on. But what we try to do initially is to tell people that making an effort to think about the water and try to absorb as much as they can, even if they were to be able to capture half of their water, they're that much farther than the average homeowner who's not even paying attention to that.
And Andrea, one of the things that you and I talked about in an earlier conversation was we sort of talked about texture and leaf shape, which is, I think, something that people don't necessarily think about.
Yes. I think this is what Jim is also talking about. When he talks about clumping and focal point, he's bringing in those same design considerations that I would. And texture of the leaf or of the plant or the form of the plant are also very powerful tools for making a garden look planned and attractive. I've noticed that a lot of native plants have a very fine texture, and that seems to make them somewhat uniform. So we need to be aware of those characteristics and search out things which can bring interesting contrast. So, for example, with those fine textured goldenrods, for example, let's bring something with a really big leaf in, like the compass plant, Silphium. Or let's bring in, as I said, a non-native plant like the Rogersia or Rogers flower, and combine those together into an interesting combination that increases the attractiveness of the garden close up.
And what about maintenance? One of the things that people talk about with native plants is that once they're established, once you've planted them and you've watered them well for their first year, that they're lower maintenance than some of the exotic plants. And if you introduce exotic plants into a rain garden, aren't you kind of subverting the low maintenance aspect of it?
I think that the right plant in the right place is the phrase that we apply to all plants. We select native plants very carefully for their growing culture, their growing needs, water or no water, and we select the exotics for their same growing needs and combine them appropriately. You mentioned an interesting thing about maintenance, which is that you need to think about the kind of season your rain garden has. Is it sod and wet in the spring and then dry as toast in the late summer? Then you need to pick plants which can tolerate seasonal wetness. That's my garden, my rain garden. Or is it the kind of place that's always soggy and you'd better pick plants that like it always soggy? And if you pick those plants correctly, you'll have practically no maintenance problems because you have given them what they need and they will grow happily.
Folks, if anybody has any questions about rain gardens or any other garden topics, give us a call at 773-838-WCPT. That's 773-838-9278 here at the Mike Novak Show on WCPT. And, Andrea, you know, that's something that I often think about with native plants. I think a lot of people think sort of any native plant is better than any exotic plant. But I remember, I've talked to a number of people about this, and all native plants are not evolved to grow in the same circumstances. And in fact, especially in the city of Chicago and in the suburbs where the soil's been disturbed, we can't really offer those plants the conditions, especially the soils that they evolved for. So you have to not lump native plants together in your mind and apply the same sort of right plant, right place criterion to selecting native plants that you would to selecting exotic perennials. Am I right about that?
I think I'd take the opposite tack.
Really?
The wonderful thing about native plants is that they don't all clump in the great garden middle. You know, exotic plants are chosen to grow in a sunny garden with average soil and your usual gardening practices. But native plants cover the entire spectrum, from dry prairies that practically have no rain to average prairies, mesic prairies, to prairies that grow partially in water. So that you can exploit this wonderful extreme range of adaptability to various garden conditions with native plants, which you could not do with the European imports. For example, if you've got an urban site which is dry, sunny, we hope, has low fertility, maybe it's built on rubble. This sounds terrible, but a dry prairie plant like Sidoat's Grandma, Bootaloo, Curtipendula, will be very happy there and will thrive because you've given it the very nasty conditions it loves.
Jim, let me ask you, if you have a few plants that you normally recommend for rain gardens, and then I think we're going to we have a couple of questions. We're going to ask folks to stay on the line for a few minutes while we get ready to answer a couple of questions that we have. But, Jim, let me ask you, what are some of the plants that you normally recommend for people who are planting rain gardens?
Well, I mentioned some of them earlier. Leatris is a favorite of mine.
That's the one that has the tall purple spikes, right?
Right. And the swamp milkweed, a lot of the families like lobelia, they all like, there's a great blue lobelia and there's the red lobelia, which are very spectacular plants. Then you can get into like the Carex family, which is sedges. And they stay green and short. And so there's a nice texture between some of these shorter textured Carex varieties and then these taller plumes of blooming plants that create some interest.
What about grasses? Would you want to use like the native prairie grasses in a rain garden, or are they too sort of dry soil loving?
We talk to people about the bottom of the pit. If you can imagine that this is a depression, a shallow pit, the very bottom of the pit is where you want your most water loving plants.
Okay.
And then you have the sides of the pit and the top of the pit. And certainly the grasses would be one that you would decorate with around the tops and the edges. I love prairie drop seed. It's a beautiful one. It's got a huge root system underneath it that absorbs surface water.
And it's just gorgeous in the fall.
Yeah.
It gets this wonderful yellow color in the fall. It's just great.
And it's a pretty smelling. My kids had taken the hose as they were watering, and you can water a petunia, and after about 30 seconds, the water runs off. But when they got to the drop seed, it didn't matter. They stood there for 10 minutes, and thing just absorbed water continuously.
Okay, great. I'm going to ask Andrea and Jim to hang on the phone here while we take care of some business, and then we're going to get to a couple of questions that we have waiting on hold here. We are going to take care of some business here as soon as I get organized to do it.
I've got it handy.
If you haven't picked up the January-February edition of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, you're running out of time. It's almost March, and you're going to miss out on the Get Ready for the Gardening Year edition. And this is a little plug here. I have several articles in the March-April issue. There are stories on how to interpret what's on a seed packet, how to set up grow lights to get your seedlings up to speed for outdoor planting. Speaking of seeds, if you're planning to grow tomatoes this year, there's a guide to open-pollinated heirloom varieties of seeds. And if you want to be the first on your block to have the latest and greatest varieties, Ball Horticultural's Jim Now presents his must-have list. Jim Now is like the new plant guru for the Chicago area. Chicagoland Gardening is the garden magazine for our region, which means Chicago and the environs. You can find Chicagoland Gardening Magazine in your local store or garden center. More than 800 new newsstand locations have been added in the last few months. But why trudge out to the store when you can have it delivered to your home? There's even a guy named Mike who writes a column alleged to be funny in the back of the magazine, and he writes about how to transform your yard in 20 minutes in this issue, too. He's everywhere. It's scary. Go to ChicagolandGardening.com or call 888-265-3600. That's 888-265-3800. We have two different phone numbers here, folks. You might have to try them both, or you might have to go to ChicagolandGardening.com to figure out what the phone number is.
You want to read it anyway. That's the important thing.
You want to read it anyway. This is a reading experience, folks. So go to ChicagolandGardening.com or go to your newsstand. A lot of garden centers carry the magazine. And it is a fine magazine for which both Mike and I write. So I would strongly suggest that magazine. What am I supposed to do now?
Well, the next thing that we strongly suggest is SIDS Garden Centers, which you've already discussed.
SIDS Garden Centers, but I will discuss them again. It's still a little early to get planting outside, but there are ways to start playing in the dirt. In fact, there's no time like the present to pick out your flower and vegetable seeds and start them indoors. Why start from seed? You'll save money, have fun, and you can grow exactly the varieties you like. Now is the time to start this year's vegetable garden, and SID's Greenhouses and Garden Center is ready to help. Their shipment of flower and vegetable seeds is in, so shelve those seed catalogs because SID's has what you need. Looking for other ways to get your green fix? Then plan to attend SID's 21st Annual Garden Expo coming up on March 5th and 6th in Palos Hills. You'll be able to meet the reps, attend seminars like Mike Novak's World Famous. He has this in italics, World Famous. Talk on I'm Not Really a Garden Expert, I Just Play One on the Radio, at 11:30 on Friday, March 5th. And I will point out that Mike actually is a master gardener also.
He is.
And you'll see the newest products and programs for spring. Best of all, admission and parking are free. SID's, Chicagoland's premier garden centers, are located in Palos Hills on Southwest Highway and in Bowling Brook on Napier Plainfield Road at Hassard Boulevard. Okay, we have a couple of
We have some listeners on the line. I've got Jan from Naperville, and she's got two questions for you.
All right, Jan, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am.
Tell me about your garden in Naperville. What kind of garden do you have in Naperville?
Well, I have a third of an acre, and I've developed quite a lot. I have a butterfly garden, a hummingbird garden, a white garden, and I started last year a chocolate garden.
Wow.
With chocolate-scented or chocolate-named varieties of plants, so it's fun.
That's a lot of gardening you got going on there.
It is. It's something I love to do, as just about all your listeners do, I'm sure.
So what's your first question?
My first question is, I have a swale in my yard, so there's a pretty good, like, 5 feet it goes down, and when it rains really hard, really fast, it will fill up with maybe 2 or 3 feet of rainwater for like an hour or two. Is there anything that I could plant in there that could withstand all of that water?
Jim, you want to take that one?
Sure. One of the things that we, to expand the idea of a rain garden, when the rain garden is in a linear fashion, that's called a bioswale. So it's just another name for a linear-shaped rain garden, and that's what we're talking about here, a ditch. And the opportunity here is to build that rain garden to absorb that water even faster and make sure that it doesn't get through the culvert and on down to the creek. So we even offer a service where I can come out and help you go through it. You can look at our website, theconservationfoundation.org, to see that. But certainly the plants that we talked about earlier, the sedges and lobelia, even things like coneflower and black-eyed Susan, works very well on the edges of these ditches. And then in the very bottom, the milkweed is a beautiful plant to put in there, lobelia.
Okay, is there any city ordinance that would prevent me from doing that? There are two drainage sewers in my yard.
Many times those ditches are actually in the parkway, so that is city property, and you probably should call to see if it is a problem in your municipality, but oftentimes you're given the responsibility of maintaining that part of the parkway, and these plants are considered an improvement. Almost all the cities understand the concept of stormwater loss, and your effort to try to stem that loss should be appreciated in most communities.
Okay, thank you very much. I will check out your website.
And what's your second question?
My second question is, why, oh why, is the symposium and the Flower and Garden Show and SID's Open House all on the same weekend? I mean, somebody has to lose out, and it'll be me, because I can't be everywhere in the same couple of days. I know the garden show goes longer than that first week, but
actually, you know, the Morton Arboretum's Garden Symposium is 3 days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and you can go any one day you wish. The Sunday portion involves a behind-the-scenes tour of the Flower and Garden Show, so you could get double benefit. I'd check out that symposium and see if that'll cover everything you want to do.
Oh, but then there's SID's.
I'm sorry, I can't help with SIDS.
That's at mortonarb.org.
Mm-hmm. I've already signed up for Friday is my problem, and I'd love to go to SIDS on Friday. So.
Okay.
But anyway.
And of course the Chicago Flower and Garden Show is coming up at Navy Pier.
Right.
And there are an awful lot of seminars associated with the Chicago Flower and Garden Show. both Mike and I will be speaking at different times. So if you're interested in that, you might want to check out their website at chicagoflower.com, or all these links are on my blog at growinginchicago.com. And if anybody who's looking for garden centers in the Chicago area, one of the best sources for that is Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, because a lot of them do advertise in Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. So does that help you at all?
Yes, it does. Thank you. I'll split myself in two and go everywhere.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Good luck, Jan. Thank
Thanks.
You.
Bye.
And now we have another question from Samuel in Oak Lawn. Samuel, you there?
Yes. I read about the tomatoes last year in the Tribune that you did.
Oh, well.
That whole series. I have a shoplite, you know, in the 4-foot a grow tube and a regular white
right.
fluorescent lamp. And then I have lettuce and cabbage in seed trays. And the third was pansies.
Mm-hmm.
The pansy says it needs darkness to germinate. The lettuce says it needs light to germinate. The cabbage doesn't say anything at all about light or dark.
Okay, well, germination is something that sort of happens before you put them under light. And germination is when the seed is just beginning to sprout, when the embryo of the plant that's inside the seed sort of pokes through the seed coat.
The roots are growing.
And so a lot of plants, you know, they're actually evolved for their seeds to germinate under the soil, so they do need darkness. So if you sow the pansy seeds according to the package directions in your seed starting mix, and then you keep it in darkness just until you see those first little green tips of the pansies.
Well, the tray, you know, is like four multiple cells, you know, like 4x9s, nine cells in a mini tray within the four tray, you know, within the large tray.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a cardboard box and covered the end that the pansies were in, that one cell, with a little shade there from the box. Is
okay.
that considered good? And then the other three within the tray would have the, you know, the grow light.
Yeah. Andrea, what have you...
The question of whether seeds needs light or dark to germinate is one based on their adaptation to their cultural conditions, which you don't really need to worry about. But often it's as simple as sowing the light-requiring seeds on the surface with no covering of soil.
Even though it says a quarter of an inch depth?
It very close to the surface. And the ones that need darkness, they're saying essentially sow them slightly under the soil. That will block the light. So I think it's a question of the relation of the seed to the surface of the soil.
So in other words, the pansy seeds that want to be dark, if they're under a quarter inch of the soil's starting mix, they'll be in the darkness. The seed starting mix will be blocking them from the light. So
the covering of the cardboard, just remove that. It's not going to prove anything at this point.
It's probably superfluous.
Yeah. Well, it's confusing.
Yeah.
Okay. You might do an experiment. I love experimenting. Try both and see what happens.
Yeah,
and
I have two
take
trays.
Notes.
One is, you know, both. I have two trays, and one is, you know, and one is on one end and one is on the other end. So I'll remove the one of the cardboard shade and see what happens that way.
Yeah, sure. I love to experiment with gardens, and that's one of the things that you can do with seeds, because seeds are so cheap.
Yeah.
You can try a few of them one way and a few of them another way, and you can sort of take bigger chances with seeds than you could if you were buying those, you know, $10 1-gallon perennials. So
then you get disease, too.
Then you can get disease, too.
Yeah.
That's true.
You know, last year the Tribune had the article about the Daylily Society.
Yes.
And I harvested, a couple sets of Daylily seeds, and they're in the refrigerator since the fall.
Okay.
how am I going to start them up? You know, there was a website for them.
These are daylily plants that are in your, or they're bare root?
There were bare root. They had flowers, and then the pods, they opened up eventually, and I picked off all the seeds within the pots.
Okay, well, I'll be honest with you, I've never actually grown daylilies from seed.
So that's another experiment.
That's another experiment. I would sow them out in your garden in the spring and see what happens.
Great.
An awful lot of gardening is, sow it out in your garden and see what happens.
Yeah.
So thanks very much for calling, Samuel. We really appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So, Jim, are you there?
Yes.
So talk to us a little bit more about this Conservation at Home program and what you do and what other things you recommend to homeowners besides rain gardens.
We try to get people thinking about the way naturally things happen and what's been going on here. People don't understand that our area was covered with prairie. So when we're talking about sustainable landscaping, what will be here, what won't need all these chemical applications and soil amendments and all this work that and inputs that people have to do in their yards, that there are some easy ways to put the right plant in the right place and let it go. People will call me, I walk their yard with them, we look at shaded areas, for example, and they say, well, nothing will grow here, it's too shady. What they're saying is they can't grow grass underneath their oak tree.
Right.
And I explained to them that grass wasn't supposed to be under an oak tree. Grass comes from Europe, and it doesn't do well in heavy shade. And look at these trillium and Jack in the Pulpit and shooting stars and these beautiful Virginia bluebells that could be growing in this area. And why are you fighting the grass?
Yeah, people have a very, very strong attachment to grass, and they sort of think of grass as the default plant. But I have a big, big patches of the native wild ginger that do beautifully in my shady garden under trees.
Right, and so when you show people that, and the same thing happens in dry areas. The sun bakes on this area, and it's nothing will grow here. And you show them buffalo grass or the side oats grandma or the butterfly milkweed is just a beautiful orange blossom that wants it baking hot.
Yeah, and the swamp milkweed is also, it's a monarch caterpillar host plant, right?
There's three different milkweeds that are native in this area. The common milkweed, which you see along the roadsides, not quite as showy. The swamp milkweed, which is a wet lover, and the butterfly milkweed, which is a dry-loving plant. And that's certainly, that butterfly milkweed is probably the most underused. It's Asclepias tuberosa, the most underused plant around. It's absolutely beautiful. It only grows about knee-high, big, bright orange flower, and it's a magnet for butterflies.
Andrea, you design a lot of gardens in the Oak Park area. You're on the board of the Friends of the Oak Park Conservatory. And do you, from your customers, do you hear a lot of demand for wildlife gardening, for butterfly gardens, for attracting birds?
The wildlife gardening concept doesn't go over too well because we seem to have our own rats. Raccoons, opossums as big as houses. So
yes.
People are not too thrilled with that. In very small properties, it seems like nature is too close. People love butterfly gardens, and they love bird gardens. And they also do ask for sustainable gardens, meaning the kinds of gardens we're talking about today. So there is a very strong movement for gardens to have character and benefit to the environment as well as to the people.
And what kinds of things do you put in a garden that's designed to plant butterflies? To attract butterflies. We've already talked about monarch butterflies a little bit. Talk to me about some other plants.
Let's see. I look at a mix. The coneflowers are wonderful. Some of the annuals like lantana are also very attracting. Do remember the larval plants, anything that you might put in your herb garden, such as fennel or dill, don't attract the beautiful butterfly, but they feed the larvae, the young butterflies, and that's how you're going to get old butterflies, mature butterflies.
Like caterpillars, basically.
The caterpillars, yes.
Yeah.
My mind has just gone blank as to other butterfly plants, and maybe Jim can think of some.
Yeah. Jim, what are some good butterfly plants?
Well, the Leatris that I talked about earlier, there's two or three different varieties that are magnets for butterflies. They will be attracted to a lot of the native plants for nectar sources, so the coneflower, black-eyed Susans. They're attracted to the prairie clover. So a lot of the prairie stuff that you're normally seeing are either nectar sources or would be larval places for the egg-laying adults to utilize.
Because when the butterflies are in the caterpillar stage, they're eating different things than after they go through their metamorphosis and become a butterfly. So you got to think about both stages of, as Andrea said, you got to think about both stages of life if you're going to attract butterflies. So I got my two guests here. We've got Jim Kleinwachter of the Conservation. Am I pronouncing that right at all?
Yes, very good.
Jim Kleinwachter of the Conservation Foundation in Naperville and Andrea Green of Gardens by Design in Oak Park. You can find the Conservation Foundation at conservationfoundation.org, and you can find Andrea Green's website at andreatgreen.com. And these links are also on my blog at growinginchicago.com. And I want to thank you both very much for spending this time with us and giving us this good information about rain gardens and other kinds of gardens.
Thank you, Beth, and good talking with you, Jim.
Yeah, it's been great.
Andrea will be speaking on how to have a prettier rain garden at the Morton Arboretum Symposium, Midwest Gardening Symposium, and you can find out about that's on March 6th, and you can find out about that at mortonarb.org. Here's a tip from The Care of Trees. Do you know that the Care of Trees has 24-hour emergency service? Winter storms can result in broken limbs or even downed trees. The weight of storm-damaged trees is great, and they can be very dangerous to remove or prune. And if they've fallen on cars, other structures, or even other trees, that complicates removal even more. The Care of Trees offers a 24-hour emergency service to assist in performing the job safely while minimizing further risk to your property. With 9 locations, the Care of Trees has been serving Chicagoland for 60 years. The Care of Trees shares your enthusiasm for the many ways trees enhance the quality of your life. And the Care of Trees combines that joy with a dedication to the utmost in client care, putting you and your trees first. Make the Care of Trees your permanent partner in enhancing the value of your landscape. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard, you're changing your landscaping, or you're moving, invite the certified arborist at the Care of Trees to take a look. See thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. That's 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees. Their business is people and their love for trees.
DR Services Unlimited has been providing Chicago's North Shore with award-winning remodeling and design-build services since 1991, giving their clients top-quality service and real value. They're on the cutting edge of green building technology, helping clients make their home more energy efficient without sacrificing beauty or function. If you want to make your home more energy efficient, simply want to add a room or renovate, call DR Services at 847-998-1687 or visit them at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
So this is the Mike Novak Show on WCPT 820 AM. I am, as I keep telling you, not Mike Novak. Mike Novak is taking the day off, and I am guest hosting. I am Beth Botts. I'm a garden writer in Chicago, and I have a blog at growinginchicago.com, where you will find a lot of links about various things we've talked about on this show. This is Self-Help Sunday. It is part of the Sunday morning House and Home lineup here on WCPT. And Mighty House is up next.
Yes, they are. Good guys.
Good guys. Yeah. Answer a lot of questions about how to take care of your home. And I just wanted to mention a couple of things that are coming up on the Chicago gardening scene. On February 25th, which is, I think, this coming Thursday, the Midwest Ecological Landscaping Association is going to be having its conference up at Chicago at the Chicago Botanic Garden. This is actually kind of a trade group for people who are in the landscape industry. But if there's anybody who's sort of in the landscape trade, in the horticultural trade, garden centers, growers, landscapers, who doesn't know about MELA, it's really worth checking out, because this is an organization that is dedicated to finding more sustainable ways to do sort of the business of greening in Chicago. And their website is at melaweb.org. Another thing that I was just recently happy to hear about is that the Antiques and Garden Fair is coming back this spring at the Chicago Botanic Garden. I think they took a year off last year. But they will be having an Antiques and Garden Fair from April 16th through April 18th. And it is a, you know, it's kind of fun to go up there. They have a whole lot of very high-end antique dealers as well as garden antique dealers. And if you're in the market for something really gorgeous to create, that kind of focal point in your garden like Andrea Green was talking about, it's really worth checking that out. It also tends to be happening at a time when there are lots of beautiful bulbs and things growing in the grounds all through the Botanic Garden. You know, April is when those gardens up there really, really start to pop. And they, you know, they have all the containers planted so beautifully, and it can really be sort of a balm to your soul to be wandering around up there. And plus, you can look at all these, you know, high end antiques that you can't afford, but you can get a lot of ideas for kinds of things that you might use for a focal point in your garden, even if you can't afford the, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 garden statue. Another thing is, we've talked about the University of Illinois Extension is going through a crisis, a funding crisis that is leading to a big reorganization. And they're having public hearings on that reorganization coming up on March 2nd in St. Charles and on March 12th in Countryside. Yeah, if you want more details about this, the link is on my blog at growinginchicago.com. And the reason this matters to gardeners is because the University of Illinois Extension runs the Master Gardener Program, which is the in all of the collar counties around Chicago, but especially in Chicago, very, very active, provides a lot of volunteers to green causes and green projects, as well as being a great source for anybody anywhere in the Chicago region to ask garden questions. They also provide a lot of, you know, things that you wouldn't think of, like pesticide safety training. They run the 4-H clubs. And they're raising the next generation of gardeners. So the University of Illinois Extension is, you know, you might think of it as just being about farmers downstate, but it's actually very active and very involved in the Chicago area. So that link is on my blog at growinginchicago.com. And of course, the other thing that's coming up is the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, which will be on Navy Pier from March 6th to 14th, and a lot of gorgeous gardens. There's a new layout this year that Terry Gouin has done to make it sort of more like strolling through Versailles rather than just marching through a trade show. And both Mike and I will be speaking. And you can find more information about that at the link that you will find on my blog, growinginchicago.com.
I want to go to the flower show this year. I've never gone.
Oh, well,
and
you
I totally
absolutely
want to go.
We've got to get you to the flower show.
I
want to
go.
Year. And one of the things that they're going to be talking about, a lot of the speakers will be talking about is vegetable growing and how to grow vegetables, how to grow them in small spaces, how to find a place to grow vegetables. One of the two talks that I'm doing at the Flower Show is about that on March 12th. We're actually going to do a sort of a walk and talk in the evening. This is at 6:15 on that evening. My plan is to sort of, you know, take a group of people and walk through the show and point to things and say, you know, that's a place where you could grow a vegetable and you know, or grow some kind of food.
That's awesome. That's cool.
And so we'll see how that works out. But it's the first time they've done this kind of thing.
Well,
so.
You're not just sitting there listening to a lecture.
You're not just
you're active.
To a lecture.
That's good. That's...
And so, but there's actually, especially if you look at the seminar schedule, there's a lot of stuff about vegetable growing. I think on just about any day that you go to the flower show, there will be at least one talk about vegetable growing. So. Especially for new gardeners, that's a really good thing. You can take in all these flowers, real flowers in March, and then also get some good information that you can use in your garden.
Well, that I can't wait. It's going to be a good time. And I want to. What's Mike talking about? Do we know what he's talking about at the flower show?
Mike is just going to be Mike.
Uh-huh.
You know? Mike is going to do that Mike thing. The Mike thing
fantastic.
Is always entertaining, folks.
I believe that.
It is always entertaining. For regular listeners of this show, you know that the Mike thing is always entertaining.
Yeah, he knows how to put on a show and be informative and entertaining.
He does.
Hence
not.
Why he has the Mike Novak show.
The Mike Novak show, which is what this is, folks.
Right?
We are on WCPT 820 AM in Chicago. Chicago's Progressive Talk, and this is the Mike Novak Show, although I am, in fact, not Mike Novak.
Yeah. It's girl party here today, garden party here today.
That's right. It's a hen party here on the Mike Novak Show.
Yeah. Well, we've got Mighty House coming up at 10 o'clock. They're going to be with us shortly, and we're going to have CNN News in a couple of minutes, but I just want to tell you, Beth, you did a great job.
You did a
wonderful, wonderful job. Master Gardener Extraordinaire, and we can read you in the Tribune today?
Yes, I do have a story in the Tribune today, and I'll have a story in the Tribune next Sunday, too.
All right, well, very good. We just got about a minute to wrap up on I'm excited. I know we had a few errors, again, showing that it's live radio here in the Showcase Pulaski Studios at WCPT Radio, but... So,
you know, you wouldn't know it's live.
Right, exactly. It would be fun if we weren't attacked by our gremlin at least once, correct?
Or the Mighty House
right.
guys.
Or the Mighty House guys.
They're on their way in. They're lurking out in the hall.
Yeah, well, they're anxious.
They're
ready
anxious.
To go.
They're very anxious. But, you know,
you
be ready.
A great job, too.
Oh, I hope so. Well, good. Right. You know, it's like I'm earning my stripes here, as they say. This is my hazing ritual to come on in and... Yeah,
there's more ritual paddling outside.
Well, CNN will be on in a few seconds, so I just want to say thank you all for listening. It's been fun, and Beth, again, you did an amazing job. So
it's been a learning experience.
I hope Mike lets us let the inmates run the asylum again soon.
Yeah,
I hope
it's been fun.
Yes.
It's been great fun, and thanks for listening, folks.
Yeah, CNN News coming up in.
Five, four,
three,
God.
Exactly. It's skirting itself with me here.
I have no idea when it is.
Yeah.
Okay, we're having another gremlin attack.
It's been interesting.
All these people are pushing buttons.
Right, it's
frantically
right.
trying to push buttons. It's like in the movies, you know, when they're trying to avert nuclear holocaust.
Right.
We'll do the classic fade up and then
yeah.
we'll let you guys run
soothing.
Out.
Soothing. Thanks
go.
For listening, folks. It's WCPT Radio.